Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
M-S-W Media.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. One rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich, and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello and welcome to Clean Up on Aisle 45. This is episode 85. It is Wednesday, August 31st. I am your host, now verified on Twitter, Allison Gill. Well, Mueller, she wrote verified on Twitter. I'm still not a real boy. But joining me today is real boy and real life lawyer, Andrew Torres. Hello.
As far as Twitter is concerned, I am equally imaginary. So I am super duper jealous, but happy. More happy than jealous that you finally got your little blue check mark. Neither of my accounts have one. So there you go. But how are you doing today?
Good. I'm excited to get my invitations to the super secret blue check parties.
Oh, yeah. I heard they're like Madison Cawthorn style.
It's where we collect our George Soros checks. So I'm very excited about that. I'm also excited to talk today with you about a bunch of stuff that happened over the weekend, including a preliminary order from Judge whatever her name is. Down in Florida, and that's in the Nara. I'm calling it the Nara Lago case.
I like that. I like that.
And then also we have a DOJ preliminary response that came back. I think first thing this morning. We're also going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Lindsey Graham and his motion to quash subpoenas in the Fulton County DA case, along with Governor Kemp. He got a bullshit decision, in my opinion, today. Allowing him to postpone his testifying, his deposition or whatever before the grand jury, the special purpose grand jury down there in Fulton County till after the election, which makes no sense to me. And I want to just quickly mention something that happened with Beryl Howell and her order to loosen up the redaction bars on a search warrant that was executed on Senator Burr back in 2020. Which I think was done, personally, I think that was done in retaliation for his work on the Senate Intel Committee with their reports on Russian collusion. He was removed. He was put under investigation and then removed from his position on the committee, allowing Marco Rubio to write up a letter saying no collusion. And so it's just absolutely bonkers. But we're going to get to see more of that today to help us determine whether or not that investigation was, in my opinion, retaliatory or not, or if they just, you know, went easy on him. We're not sure. But we have all this stuff to go over, and I'm super stoked. But before we do that, we have some new patrons.
Indeed we do. And I want to give a very special thanks to Jacob Greenleaf, to Susan Hudson, Aubrey Ritzeny, Laura Friedman, Alexander von Hungen, Rochesterian sending good emotional and mental vibes. That is in response to my having dropped my only son off at college in Rochester this past week. So thank you so much. I appreciate that. Tor 2, Ray Lynn, Tanya, Reva Katz Nelson, Fred Nangle, Bob Ryder, Lord Voldescott, like that, Lizanne Whitlow, Jeffrey Smith, and Patrick. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. If you want your own shout out, you want access to the good stuff, and you want to just, you know, help keep us going here, you know how to do that. Head on over patreon.com/aisle45pod. That's AISLE 45POD. And, you know, give us as little as a buck an episode, and we will read whatever heartwarming messages you have decided to embed in your username, or, you know, insults. We're not picky. We just want the dollar. So
thank you. That's a lot of new patrons. Wow. I'm really excited. Is.
Thank you.
Maybe because the cleanup now on aisle 45 is been shoved into overdrive.
It kind of feels like it, doesn't it?
It does, for once, since I've been trying to get this shit done since 2017.
Well, you and me both. I actually said on yesterday's opening arguments that for the first time, having looked at the redacted search warrant, right, and getting a sense of like what's going through the DOJ's head. And again, you know, there's a ton of error bars and reading tea leaves and all that. I feel like I'm willing to say I think it's more likely than not that Donald Trump will be indicted by the DOJ.
No, and I agree.
I don't know if you feel like we've crossed that threshold yet. Yeah, yeah.
I agree. I just don't think, I personally think that they'll wait until after the election, even though he's not running. I know he's not running. But he has endorsed multiple candidates, and he is the de facto head of the Republican Party, one of the two major parties that we're voting for in November. If they indict him prior to the election, I will be surprised.
I share that view. And let's also keep in mind the 1-6 committee resumes its work, its public facing work, in a couple of weeks in September. And so
yeah, they don't have to wait.
Yeah, they do not. And for all of the reasons that we have talked about, I do not think that that indictment would come down while there are still public hearings pending from the 1-6 committee. So
right.
I agree
with
you
100%. I don't think an indictment will come down in the coup. But I think we might see an indictment in the documents, this Mar-a-Lago case we're about to dive into, ahead of anything from the coup. I don't think they're, unless they're connected, unless he's got some January 6th documents in there he was trying to scuttle away. But,
so,
you know, we'll see.
So, yeah, let me, you are correct to kind of tease those two apart. And I just think that it would surprise me if, while you are trying to steal everything you can get your hands on of value, which is very clearly, you know, what these documents are, right? These are top secret documents of the kind that you could sell overseas. We've talked about that.
Yeah. FISA, Humint, SIGINT, like all of the big.
Yeah. Exactly.
Whoppers.
Why would you not? As long as you're like throwing shit in boxes and giving to the movers to send down to Mar-a-Lago, why would you not also try and cover up your criming in connection with 1-6? It strikes me as plausible anyway. So
yeah, no, my dream come true is that everything going back to 2016 is wrapped up in one huge giant conspiracy case. But I have a feeling some of the obstructive acts laid out in the Mueller report might serve as evidence for pattern of behavior in an obstruction case, 1519 or 1512 C2, both, either the coup and Mar-a-Lago. I just don't, I think it's for me, but you know, and I'm an eternal optimist, but to wrap all these up into one giant motherfucker, I think is probably not the case. So I think they might separate out the documents, might separate out the coup, but I do think we'll see. I really do think we'll see some of the obstructive acts in 2016 and 2017 as, you know, putting it into the whole picture of the evidence, like the whole body of evidence of a pattern. But, you know, I don't know, because, you know, the statute of limitations clock doesn't start ticking until you stop criming. And he hasn't stopped criming since day one.
He will never stop criming. I think that's really, really interesting. I want to endorse one part of what you have just said, because I think it further helps parse out what I was saying, right? Which is, although I think that the Mar-a-Lago, I love that, indictment will not come out until after DOJ is substantively convinced that they will not contradict in terms of witnesses with the 1-6 committee, right? And until after the election, for all the reasons that you've said.
I see.
I want to also endorse the position that you just said, which is, I think these indictments will be discreet, right? Not EET, ETE, right? Will be in specifically defined areas, because you're going to have to deal with, right? Just like the Manafort prosecution, the idea that, you know, you may get a MAGA hat wearing idiot undercover on the jury, right? And so you've got to get those people over the hump. And the way in which you get those people over the hump is not this trial is a referendum on how you feel about Donald Trump, but rather this trial is a referendum on crimes. And regardless of how you feel about Donald Trump, here is the crime. Here are the crimes that were committed in this set of transactions. And so I think the more clearly you can define that, the better. At least, again, I'm not a prosecutor, but if I were a prosecutor, that's how I'd want to bring my case in front of a jury that might contain people who voted for Trump, might contain Republicans, might contain people who are sympathetic to, you know, God help me, the whole, you know, the witch hunt argument. So,
yeah, you always go for the slam dunk. We did have a rural juror in the Manafort jury box. And so, you know, when Andrew Weissman wrote in his book, you know, we had enough on Manafort to get him for conspiracy against the United States, to defraud the United States when he handed over polling data to Kilimnik. We just didn't charge that. It was a lot harder to prove than his 18 tax felonies or business fraud felonies. Yeah. So we went with that. And it was the right way to go because they got the sentence, you know, and if they had charged them both, it would probably have been served concurrently anyway. So they got the years. It was just that he was pardoned. But they did have that rural juror who was like, I didn't care about Rick Gates and I like Trump, but the documents don't lie. So, yeah. You know.
And they and to be clear, they convicted on 10 of those 18.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And look, I'd be happy with the conviction against Donald Trump. So, yeah, we're saying the same thing.
There may be prosecutorial discretion involved here, yep, where they say we're not going to do obstruction from the Mueller. We're not going to do the seditious conspiracy of the coup, but we'll go for the fraudulent elector scheme and documents.
Yeah, like the decision that was made during impeachment, right? I mean, you know, the Trump administration was a walking impeachment from day one. That's why we coined Yodel Mountain, right? Like, it was obvious, you know, pick the felony that he's committed. But the idea was to try and maintain a focused and narrow case to the American public. And again, right, I think people are passing lightly over the fact that in connection with January 6th, not only did that impeachment get 7 Republican votes, there were 24 others, including Mitch McConnell, who said, well, you know, I'm not voting guilty because I think we lack jurisdiction over a former president who's out of office. Right.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that Moscow Mitch wouldn't lie and contrive some other? Who knows? Right. Like, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that in terms of looking at that presentation, if you've let the Republicans gaslight you into thinking that that was a big failure or a nothing burger or didn't move the noodle, like that's wrong.
No,
like,
it's evidence. It's evidence, absolutely, that will be used. And so I think the Mueller stuff, although it might not be charged, but if they do roll these up into one thing, I don't think we'll see it until spring of next year, not after the election.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that the more tailored indictment is more likely. And Man, I would love to see that on, you know, November 9th or 10th, but we'll see. So,
yes. Okay, so all right. Mar-a-Lago, what did this judge say? What is this preliminary order where she has an inkling she'll probably want to appoint a special master? She doesn't address the jurisdictional problems at all and asks the DOJ to file a response to the Trump filing by yesterday, which right. is tomorrow for us.
So angry sighing first, and then let me get into the analysis. So, but seriously, let me take a step back, because to understand this, you have to understand, I know, Allison, you do, but our listeners have to understand just how incompetent, and I would argue deliberately incompetent, the former president's initial filing in this case was. Okay. And I will do that by contrasting it with what every lawyer, left, right, and center, including the president's lead lawyer in this, Jim Trustee, right, who has handled tons of, I mean, you know, not the president, but has handled tons of white collar criminal defense cases. He knows that what you do in this case is you file a complaint. Right. This was the DOJ. So it would have to be asserting Bivens causes of action. Right. Violation of constitutional rights. And then you file with that a motion for injunctive relief. Right. For a temporary restraining order, preliminary injunction. You file that pursuant to Rule 65 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and usually supported with an affidavit that explains why you have irreparable harm.
So wait, did they do any of that?
They didn't do any of that. What they filed was a motion for judicial oversight and additional relief as its own standalone pleading in a separate court in order to randomly roll the dice and not wind up with Magistrate Judge Bruce Reinhart, who signed off on the search warrant for Mar-a-Lago. And instead, they drew Federalist Society weirdo and Trump appointee Eileen Cannon. Okay. And the question you're asking is, do Federalist Society weirdos and Trump appointees still display unbelievable favoritism to their patron? The answer, at least in this case, is yes. Right. So here's what happened. That first pleading they filed, judicial oversight and additional relief, was so bad that, number one, it triggered the case to come up on the pro se docket, right? The bright red lights going off saying...
We were all like, is Trump representing himself?
Which, no, like, we do not live in a universe in which we are blessed enough to have Trump representing himself in court. But no, it triggered the pro se because they screwed up so many things at the outset that, you know, CMECF, which we access through paper, through Pacer, is like, well, you know, looks like a 12-year-old is trying to file something. We're just going to label this pro se, right? His lawyer, despite the fact that one of his lawyers was admitted in Florida, like the others didn't move pro hoc vice. They clicked the wrong buttons. It was a comedy of errors, except for the fact that it was filed by, you know, an insurrectionist.
Yeah, but besides the electronic filing yep. idiocy, they literally left off relief.
Everything.
Like, yeah, nothing. There was not. They were like, okay,
they
cool.
lied
you're just,
on the
like,
cover
you're mad?
Page. Yeah, yeah. No, they lied on the cover page, as I discussed in some detail on yesterday's opening mm-hmm. arguments. But like the reason they lie on the cover sheet is because you have to state the basis for jurisdiction on your cover sheet, and they don't have one here. Right? This is just. Where I'd like the court to do something for me. So on her own, sua sponte, Judge Cannon, Federalist Society weirdo, decides to issue an order on August 23rd. And it says, this court is in receipt of plaintiff's motion for judicial oversight. That's docket number one. So on or before last Friday, right, August 26th, plaintiffs shall file a supplemental motion and address the following, and gives them yeah. a 5-point roadmap, right?
What do you want? Why are you here?
Yeah.
Who are you?
Have you served the United States of America?
Did you even tell the DOJ that you're...
No. And the answer to that is no, because again, they didn't file a complaint. They didn't comply with the basics of the law. So, That was, yeah, 5 points. And you've summarized it correctly, right?
Could have filed a better filing.
You could have filed a better filing, like, while drunk in Uzbekistan, right? Like, I mean, we're going to get to it. Okay. So that order said, hey, man, this is nonsense. file a supplemental brief, and I want you to address five things. Number one, the asserted basis of our jurisdiction. Number two, what the framework is for that jurisdiction. Number three, what you want, including any request for injunctive relief. Number four, the effect that this would have on the fact that, you know, there's an open proceeding and these cases should be consolidated. And number five, oh, by the way, have you served the United States? So that pleading came in Friday night. And we held off recording OA, Tuesday's OA, until Saturday morning so that I could read it. And it is a dumpster fire idiocy of a pleading, right? Like, it barely touches these issues. It doesn't understand most of them. And it is clear to me, right? Like, my conclusion at the end of this was, oh, this is the kind of thing you file when you're getting dragged on Fox News by Laura Ingraham saying, I don't understand why they, you know, it's been 2+ weeks. And you haven't asked them, like, to, you know, not to search your stuff, right?
Right. Yeah, I even tweeted out. I'm like, they're facing sanctions. They've opened up an opportunity for DOJ to respond and, quote unquote, speak in a filing. And they've done all this. They've completely embarrassed themselves by their attempts to file on the docket. And all of this because Laura Ingraham got mad at Christina Bob on Fox News. That's the whole reason this entire stupid filing was made in the first place.
You would think, right? So I'm in total agreement, 100%. That was the reason for this slapdash filing. And when I say slapdash, right, I literally mean that, right? Like, so for example, when the section of the brief that says address the effect of this filing on the proceeding before Magistrate Judge Reinhardt, they just say, oh, that's a different case. I mean, literally, it is a 5-line paragraph on page 9 that says, and two of those lines are, the court has asked us to do. And all they say is, the litigation will have no effect on the litigation before Magistrate Judge Reinhardt. The two matters involve distinct legal issues. Movant is not a party to the litigation before Judge Reinhardt. Moreover, Judge Reinhardt does not have the authority to provide the relief sought here. That's wrong, by the way. And that's it. Like, you might remember from, you know, every episode of this show that, like, usually in legal proceedings, when you say something like the two matters involve distinct legal issues, you would say, right, matter A involves these issues, matter B involves these. Nope. Usually when you say things like Judge Reinhardt does not have the authority to provide the relief sought here, you would have a citation, right, to a case or multiple cases or a statute. No, like, this is literally just, I've read you the entirety of what this brief says on a major point that the court asked for, you know, to be briefed. And then you get to the service aspect. And this is a thing that I think our listeners might pause too lightly over, because in some ways service feels like a super technical kind of thing, right? Like, you know, when you think about, I don't know, like the Dukes of Hazzard or whatever, and like, you know, looks like them Duke boys are about to leave the county so that they can't affect service of process, right? Like you think about that, right? Of, okay, you know, somebody wants to sue you and you're trying to evade service. When you're talking about suing the government, right, which people do on a daily basis, most of it frivolous, you have to provide kind of the bare minimum legal process to say, hey, DOJ, I'm not a crank or a crazy person. Here's the complaint that we have against you. Here's why you should take it seriously. And here's your copy. And as of August 26th, Friday, right, Donald Trump hadn't done that by and through his lawyers. Indeed, his response was, Movant will promptly serve a copy of the pleadings on the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida and will promptly file proof of service thereafter. Have not seen if they have filed that proof of service. But that assertion was made Friday night, and then we got this ruling Saturday morning. So DOJ has not been served, right? They don't even know what the allegations are against them. And that's, again, I just want to tell you that that's more than just like a technicality. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm angry.
No, it's okay. I understand. And let's talk a little bit about what the this new filing that she that this the that the judge made, the preliminary order. Can you explain sure. what a preliminary order is? Because it was like this back and forth between her and the DOJ over the weekend felt like, I'm thinking about doing a thing. And the DOJ filed back, yeah, well, we're thinking about doing a thing. Thanks. You know, it just felt weird. Like
it should feel weird because it is weird, right? Like, and here's the way in which it's weird, right? It is common in oral argument for a judge. And in fact, I appreciate this even when I'm on the losing side, right? For a judge to say to the lawyers, okay, in front of me is X motion. I'm inclined to grant it. Mr. Torres, you oppose the motion. Tell me why I shouldn't, right? Like, okay, that tells me where I stand, right? And that tells me that, boy, I thought I had, you know, five really good arguments. Like, time to triple up on my best one, right? Like,
right.
And I want that guidance, right? So that's a reasonable thing that I have seen judges do in oral argument all the time. I want to say, and again, you know, I've only been practicing law for 25 years. I've never seen this as an order communicating it, right? So it says, right, the reason it's described as a preliminary order is because in addition to the things that it requires the parties to do, which we're going to talk about, line one of the order says, pursuant to Rule 53B1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, put a pin in that, and the court's inherent authority, put a pin in that, and without prejudice to the party's objections, the court hereby provides notice of its preliminary intent to appoint a special master in this case. Okay, so let's unpack what all of that is saying. The first,
can I ask a question first?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Why did she not say, I have jurisdiction to make this decision first?
That's exactly where I was going. That's why it says this court's inherent authority, because nobody so far has provided this court with a jurisdictional basis for being able to hear this at all. And I want to be as clear as I can about this. Citing to the rules of civil procedure, those are the rules of the road that are applied when you have a civil case pending before a federal judge. Okay, they do not independently say that you have the right to be before that judge in the first place. Right? And here's the best example I can come up with kind of on the fly. If a Major League Baseball umpire shows up in your living room and says, I'm going to eject you from this living room, right? And you say, what the hell are you talking about? And he says, well, look at the rules of Major League Baseball. It says umpires have the power to eject individuals from the premises if they engage in conduct that is unbecoming of the sport of baseball. Allison, you've been swearing up a storm.
I called him a cocksucker, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, right, exactly. Time to get out. Outstanding reference. Time to get out of your living room, right? And your response would be, okay, but you haven't proven...
You have no power here. Be gone.
You have no jurisdiction over my living room, right? Yeah. You haven't proven that the rules of Major League Baseball apply in your living room. And they almost certainly don't. I mean, you know, I don't know. You have a big living room, but still. Like...
So I think, you know, well, there's always nine guys here. No. So I think...
That may be the best thing you've ever said.
Thank
and
you.
I'm going to need a second to laugh.
That's why I got verified and on
yep.
Twitter.
Yeah, there you go.
So the
lots
thing here
of corroborating witnesses.
I imagined, had she not just come in with this preliminary injunction or preliminary order, that the DOJ by Tuesday, which is yesterday if you're listening, tomorrow for us as we record, the DOJ was going to file in a response to Trump's whatever you want to call it. I imagine they were going to address the jurisdiction and say they either need to consolidate it with Reinhart, or because this is a Presidential Records Act case, pursuant to the Presidential Records Act, it must be filed in the District of Columbia Circuit. So I was assuming they would just include that in the filing. So she comes out and does this thing and doesn't address it. And DOJ responds without addressing it, like, we're going to file a thing. We're going to file our response, but we're doing a preliminary response to your preliminary
yeah.
order because you filed it in the middle of us writing our response. It's just so weird.
It is incredibly weird. So let's unpack the rest of it, and then we can talk about the DOJ's response. So that note, you are, it's one of the things I love talking law geekery with you. There is nothing that addresses the court's jurisdiction in paragraph one. This court does not have the power to conduct these hearings, does not have the power over this matter whatsoever, because federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, right? You have to come before it and show the bases for which you are in a federal court.
Yeah, she didn't even say, I have jurisdiction based on the arguments made by the Trump lawyers that I have jurisdiction. She didn't even come up with a bullshit reason that she has jurisdiction. It was just not even mentioned.
She gave, and moreover, she gave the Trump team that bullshit jurisdictional argument, and they couldn't do it, right? So point one, remember I said, was
two of her points were about jurisdiction.
Tell me why I have jurisdiction, and used the clues of whether legal or equitable / anomalous, right? And I talk a great deal about anomalous jurisdiction on yesterday's opening arguments, but like that's a clue to the former president's lawyers, to Trump's team. Hey, man, talk about anomalous jurisdiction. And they don't. They don't analyze it. And it is just mind-boggling to me that you would then say, all right, well, you know, you filed your thing and boy, did it suck even more than I imagined.
She lobbed it to him. She was like, here, do this.
It was a set that accidentally goes over the net, and the other side in volleyball is just like watching it drop, watching it slowly drop to the sand, you know, to mix like a dozen sports metaphors in this case. So when Judge Cannon says, pursuant to the court's inherent authority, that is the inherent authority to schedule and require things of litigants, okay? That is not to adjudicate this case. There was zero analysis. There is zero assertion that the court has jurisdiction. I expect that to feature prominently in yesterday's filing by the DOJ. And, you know, we'll be talking about that on our respective shows. So what does it do? It sets a scheduling order. And again, the court has the inherent power to set a scheduling order in a case that it has the power to hear. No analysis that it does. And it says, I want the government to file by Tuesday and a response to the motion and the supplement and to this, including the request for the appointment of a special master. Then I want Trump, you guys file your response on Wednesday, and then we're going to hold a hearing on Thursday at 1 p.m. Okay? Again,
in the court where this shouldn't be heard.
In the court where this should not be heard. I cannot emphasize strongly enough the idea that you have now compelled a party to attend when they do not know. There is no proof in the record that they know what the allegations are against them. I'm sorry, go ahead.
If they file, if DOJ files, hey, we got to move this, to whether they go to DC under the Presidential Records Act or they go to back to Reinhardt or wherever it needs to go, which is not there. And then Trump files his whatever. And then good old Jim Trusty will probably upload it to MySpace instead of the court docket. whatever happens in that, if they hold the hearing without addressing the jurisdictional case, I imagine the DOJ saying, we aren't going to argue anything right now except for jurisdiction.
I that's how I would argue, because I would want to preserve for the record, right, my objection. I would not want, if you argue substantively, that could be construed. It is in personal jurisdiction cases.
You're accepting the jurisdiction.
Yeah, it can be construed as an acceptance. Now, the court, this is subject matter jurisdiction.
So she says, well, what do you think about a special master, me appointing a special master? I would say, I'm not going to discuss anything with you today other than the jurisdictional issue. That needs to get solved before we talk about anything else. That's how I would run it if it even gets to the hearing after they file their jurisdictional disagreement.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I predict that that's what's going to happen. I want to be clear for our lawyers listening who, you know, love to correct errors and misperceptions. And I don't want to leave anyone with the wrong impression. You cannot voluntarily consent to subject matter jurisdiction in the courts. Right. In other words, if this is not properly before the court, then your behavior, acting as if it does not consent to that. You can raise jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, at any time.
It doesn't grant jurisdiction by through concession or default or anything.
It can, because remember, jurisdiction has two components. It has subject matter jurisdiction. Is this dispute capable of being heard in this court? Right. And personal jurisdiction. Right. Are you as a litigant capable of coming under the authority of that court? Right. And I so, see. You know, for example, if I were to sue you, Allison, in your personal capacity in Idaho, and you've never been to Idaho, right? You would, through your lawyers, move to dismiss the Idaho lawsuit on the grounds of personal jurisdiction. You would say, I'm suing you for breach of contract or something. I don't know, tort, like you made me feel and bad. I don't know, whatever. And you'd be
the
like,
subject matter jurisdiction is whether or not the court can hear it, the matter.
This request for the special master, right?
So, for example, if the Presidential Records Act requires the case to be filed in the D.C. District Circuit or the D.C. District Court, then that's subject matter jurisdiction.
That's right. And then you would transfer the case, right? And again, you know, I go back to the cover sheet. One of the things you're required to do
is
on the cover sheet is, in addition to not lying, all documents you submit with the court, you are required not to lie.
But they didn't sign an affidavit saying they didn't lie. They're supposed to attach that too.
you also are required to identify related cases. Okay.
You're supposed to hear my case because this case was heard by you and this case was heard by you.
It just says it doesn't matter. You are required, if there is a case that is related, you are required to identify it on the cover sheet. And they did not. Right. And that is, you know, do you want to chalk it up to gross incompetence or do you want to chalk it up to something more malicious? Right. Which is
more malicious.
Sucking so bad on purpose because you know that if you followed the rules, you would get people disbarred. So let's talk about that. Right. The
hence
gravamen.
Hence my talk about they're risking sanctions here.
Yep.
Seriously. I mean, because they know better.
That is exactly right. And the primary request here, the one that Judge Cannon is inclined to grant, is a request for a special master to do a thing that the search warrant already says has been done, right? That is, have an independent taint team review the documents for privilege.
Yeah, they did that on site. And, and in the DOJ's response, they did the whole, per my last email, and bless your heart, like in the unsealed affidavit Friday, we explained there was a privilege team on site. Did you read that thing that you did? I mean, because we read it and I mean, we wrote it. So, you know,
yeah. Like, I will get to the DOJ's preliminary response to this preliminary order, but that's the relief that Trump ostensibly wants in connection with this, quote, filing, right? I want a special master that's going to look at all of this and, you know, give me my stuff back at, you know, that you planted. And I don't know. That relief is moot. That relief is the kind of thing that, by the way, a magistrate judge can and in fact routinely does award. So there's nothing to have stopped
and
them.
They concede that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They concede that and think, well, sometimes she's like, well, magistrate judges don't, it's always the district court judge, except for these other, you know, except for a couple
except
of times.
Except for when it isn't. Yeah. and
like,
their efforts
suck.
Their efforts
and only,
to distinguish
only district,
that.
Only district court judges can approve injunctions. It's like, you didn't file one.
That's also nonsense. Magistrate judges can, of course.
And they can.
Yeah. The distinction that is offered in footnote 4 of the government's,
I love it,
quote, filing is, well, yeah, but those were mostly civil matters. And idiot, this is a civil matter, right? Like, yes, the search warrant is a criminal case, but when you file a motion or whatever the hell you call it, it's right there in the caption of the case that you filed. 8:22-CV, that means civil.
Charges haven't been brought. Charges haven't been brought yet. This
is
not a criminal proceeding.
This is absolutely not. So saying, yeah, but those are civil cases, this is a civil case. And remember that it's time to pull that pin, right? The judge says, you know, pursuant to my authority, pursuant to Rule 53, that's Rule 53 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So either, right, if this isn't a civil case, you don't get this relief, but it is, because we all know that it is. So it's maddening. And I really thought, like, there are some, we've talked about this before, there are some Trump appointees who are just doing their jobs. And I don't know, maybe there's a way to read this as I'm going to be so overwhelmingly favorable to the former president that nobody can doubt, you know, I make it judgment proof when I rule against him. Maybe. Okay. I'll hold that out as a potential, like, glimmer of optimism. But this sure looks like somebody, you know, with far right views paying back their patron for putting them on the bench for life. And by the way, she's like 12, right? Like Judge Kavanaugh.
She also said she would recuse from any cases that involved.
Oh, sure. Shocker. Yeah.
But
they've been real good about that. So.
Now, I don't want to say that I think judges should have to recuse if they hear cases about people they appointed or people that didn't appoint them. I don't think that's the case. She said she would, and she's not.
I'd like to have fewer cases against sitting and former presidents show up in the federal courts. So, you know,
that'd be cool.
That's my crazy optimism.
But like, I wouldn't want a Biden appointee to have to recuse themselves from a Trump case because, right. You know, or whatever, any appointee in this one first criminal investigation into a former president.
Right. And the problem is that
and it will remain the only one if we vote Democrats.
Exactly right. And the problem is that we all know that in addition to appointing legitimate judges, albeit judges with far right beliefs, Donald Trump also appointed sycophants and losers and idiots who have no business being on the federal bench. And so it's hard to craft a rule that when the rule that you're thinking is like, come on, what I really mean here is, you know, let's not have this in front of, you know, insert random Donald Trump judge who unanimously declared not qualified by the American Bar Association when, you know, went up for appointment, right? Like, we know who these people are. They, you know, Justin Walkers of the world who just have no business being on the bench. And it's hard, right? Like, and other judges struggle with that, right? So, yeah.
All right. So
let's move on to the response. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about the response. So the first thing I noticed, it's very short, it's like 3 pages. They filed notice of receipt of the preliminary motion in this case.
Got it.
And they basically, we got it. And they basically said, yeah, we got your preliminary order. We plan to file a big old response to Donald's thing, but there's some stuff you should know. This shit, we already know. The affidavit made public Friday that we had a privilege team on site. They said that. And I thought that was of import. They also said, and Donald wants us to stop looking through stuff, but also somehow wants a more detailed inventory. So, okay, we'll go through it again and give you a more detailed inventory, LOL. And then they say, we'll totally address the FPOTUS filing. But we just wanted you to know we've already gone through everything, and the Office of Director of National Intelligence already is doing a classification review and potential risk assessment. So, you know, this is you're too late, basically. And then they'll file tomorrow in response to the whole thing, which I think will just be a big jurisdictional battle personally.
I think that's exactly right. And let's be clear, there was a taint team on site, right? A privilege review team, but I prefer the classic designation,
Me too.
that began the initial segregation and then conducted that review off site. Right. So in other words, they didn't do the entirety of the privilege review at the time that they were.
Right. And they did find some stuff that had some attorney client privilege. But none of this can have executive privilege.
Well, and keep in mind the relief that Donald Trump wants, and I had to elide over this, but there's more basis for this yesterday's OA, is extraordinary, requires you to show callous disregard of the individual rights of the litigant, of the individual constitutional rights of the litigant. The fact that the search warrant itself, before anybody knew, said, oh, by the way, like, this is the former president, so we're going to be super careful when we go down. We're going to have a second team on premises ready to do kind of an initial segregation. And if there's any privileged material, they're going to be the ones that review it. They have no connection to the underlying investigation. They would have no connection to any indictment that's handed down. They are unrelated and they're going to review. Like, that is the opposite of callous disregard for your constitutional rights.
None of us get this deference.
No, of course not. Yeah.
You know, so
along with these specific, like, I want the government to itemize every single thing they've taken so that I can get back my stuff. Yeah. Why don't you try getting arrested for a street crime for that and filing that motion? That would go immediately into the circular filing cabinet. There is that nobody gets that. So,
oh, right. Like the lady who was complaining to the cops that she sold a guy some crack and he ripped her off and wanted to get her money back.
Yeah.
No, sorry. You can't have fruits of a crime back. It's just, no.
The initial thing that I thought, and let me share my initial thought and then get your response. To me, this felt roughly analogous to the Concord management stuff, right? This feels like former president's lawyers threw a bunch of crap at the wall. They expected to lose, which would have given them ammunition to go on Breitbart and OAN and say, oh, look, the system is, you know, hates us and is biased and whatever. They unexpectedly won. And now Judge Cannon is inclined to appoint a special master that now gets to, like, muck about in a criminal investigation and leak to somebody unconnected to the investigation and sympathetic to Donald Trump all of the stuff that privilege review team
is reviewing. Right, because she would appoint.
Yeah.
She would choose the special master. And it's not going to be Barbara Jones. It's
no. That just seems to me like,
fortunately, they would have to have clearance.
Yeah, that's right. That's a fair point.
So she can't just, like, appoint Kash Patel.
Jared, yeah.
I deem you special master. Then the DOJ would file a motion saying, sorry, the special master has to have TSSCI clearance. And yeah.
It feels like there is no reason to think any relief is necessary. Right? There is no discussion. I just want to point this one out, right? Because in order to gain injunctive relief, right, you have to meet the 4-part test. And the most important part is irreparable harm. There is no affidavit that this has done any harm to the president, let alone irreparable harm. The only thing we have is the lawyers saying, well, they accidentally also took his passports and gave them back. And, like, that does not rise to the level of injury, let alone irreparable injury. And so, it is bonkers that you would appoint a special master to do a thing that does not need to be done and is only going to obstruct the proceedings.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, I totally agree. I don't think, again, they're going to have clearance. I mean, you know, the ODNI already has it. You can't claw back.
Yeah.
There is no need. The DOJ, if they go beyond a jurisdiction argument, they're, you know, maybe if this gets up to DC and Trump files for a special master again with the correct court, they're going to say, look, no, it's moot now. It's completely moot. Yep. We have a special master going through it. It's called the fucking ODNI. Making sure there's nothing can be under executive privilege in requests from the executive branch to the executive branch. Biden wields that, and he did when he told NARA to make the decision on whether or not, you know, the FBI could be given these 15 boxes they got back in January. The same shit is going to apply to any other subsequent boxes we took from your fucking place. So
exactly,
and the DC court is going to be like, yeah, we agree with you. So that's where it needs to be. If they're doing this under the provisions of the Presidential Records Act, and if they don't, it needs to go back to Reinhart and be randomly assigned to some judge in D.C., probably. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, these guys drove down to this court and filed this shit with their girl. And anyway, it's ridiculous. It's all ridiculous. I can't wait to see what the DOJ has to say tomorrow, because you've given an invitation for the Department of Justice to tell us a bunch of stuff. And I'm interested to see what they tell us. I imagine it won't be too much, because they need to protect the integrity of the case, obviously, because if they plan on going forward with an indictment, this has to be airtight. But, it is there. They can speak in these court filings. So we'll see what happens. I'm expecting some really interesting stuff, especially in that the arguments for jurisdiction.
Me too.
All right, let's talk about, we've got about 15 minutes left. Let's talk about Lindsay and what happened today with Lindsay real quick.
Your favorite word, quashal. So relatedly, right, you know, the DOJ speaks through its court filings. How about Fani Willis and the district attorney's office in Fulton County, Georgia, also speaking through its court filings, filing today in the federal court case that Lindsey Graham opened to try and quash his subpoena to appear before Fani Willis's grand jury. We now get to hear Fani Willis's response to the 11th Circuit's remand. Yeah.
Because that's where we're at, right? They went up to the 11th Circuit. 11th Circuit says, go back down to the district court and you tell me, Lindsay, what you don't think you should talk about under speed. Let's hash this out before we get into the grand jury, which is stupid. It should be hashed out in the grand jury and then litigated if she wants any additional information that he claimed privilege over, or speech or debate. But we're doing it backwards. Okay. So let's talk about, so that's what the 11th Circuit did, remanded it back down to the court for them to figure this out ahead of the grand jury testimony. What did Fani Willis have to say about that?
Fani Willis said, look, these arguments, right? The relief that the 11th Circuit has ordered is to take a look at, to say, okay, you were correct, district court, that just blanket quashing of the subpoena is not appropriate relief, right? As we discussed on this show last week.
So agree with you there.
Yeah. And you then said, all right, but just sort of to nail everything down, what about partial quashal, right? What if there's some category that can be carved out? And here, Fani Willis has said, right, but all you were doing, Lindsey Graham, is repeating the sucky arguments that lost, which do not differentiate and provide the basis for upholding any kind of partial quashal whatsoever. And this is as mad as the last filing made me, like, this is one of these that I would just like to, curl up with on a cold fall evening and drink hot cocoa with. This is just it's beautiful. It is beautifully well written in a way that I hope the judge appreciates. For the third time in a single month, Senator Lindsey Graham has presented arguments to this court, insisting that it must entirely quash the subpoena issued to him by the Fulton County Special Purpose Grand Jury. In his third iteration of Senator Graham's arguments, just as in the prior two, there is no role for this court other than to serve as a rubber stamp for his conclusions. Even in a motion purportedly requesting partial quashal, Senator Graham insists that each and every possible topic of grand jury inquiry is forbidden. In so doing, the senator ignores the facts that have been presented, the findings of this court, and the historic limitations placed upon the speech and debate clause by the Supreme Court. Because the subpoena does not require the disclosure of privilege or other procedural matter, this court should deny the senator's motion. That's
Fani's filing, or
yeah,
the
that's,
district
that is,
court filing? Okay.
That is... Fani Willis's intro paragraph. I mean, once you get past the procedural stuff, that's the summary of the argument. She's exactly right. And she's already won in this court, right? Because Lindsey Graham does not have the life
preserver.
Because
she's filing this in the district court.
Yes.
Now. Yeah.
She's filing it in the district court because that's where this was remanded. Right. Mm-hmm. After the 11th Circuit stayed in part, but denied in part.
And then Lindsey, said, okay, yeah. partial quashal. I can't talk about anything, which is a total quashal.
Yeah.
And so she's saying, no, you're dumb, dismissed, or, well, you know, requesting this court dismiss. And they probably, have they come back with a decision?
Not as of when we are recording this. So, you know, not.
I bet I know what it says.
I got a good idea of what's
going on. Do you
think
they're going to have a hearing about this instead of this back and forth, you know, nope, I can't talk about everything, anything. Do you think maybe the judge will be like, yeah, no, this is dismissed. We need to come in and talk about what you can and can't talk about.
Yeah. So remember, right? Fannie Willis already won on the merits of these arguments before this district court before. So we had the procedural, right? What winds up being the shadow docket when it goes up to the Supreme Court. It, you know, in this case, it didn't. It went up to the 11th Circuit and then remanded back down to this court. To say, hey, we're going to stay the enforcement of your original order, but we want you to consider whether the partial quashal is appropriate. And what this filing does, and I wish we had the time to go through line by line because it's really brilliant, but it basically says the cumulative effect of the relief being sought here is not partial quashal, but total quashal. Right.
Right.
It is, you know, again, I'll read the concluding line on other topics. Right. Finally, the senator makes his grandest argument of all, quote, this same analysis applies to any other topic this court, the district attorney or amici can invent, such as media appearances, end of quote. So if the top, and this is Fannie Willis's analysis. So if the topic involves the 2020 elections, it is an impermissible backdoor to questions about Senator Graham's motives. But if it does not, it falls outside the scope of the investigation. Thus, we finally arrive at the place where we began. The senator's arguments for partial quashal inevitably slide into an argument for total quashal. And it's just true. Like if there was merit to this argument, right, you would say, hey, I want an order from the court that says you can't ask me about X, right? Because you could easily imagine things related to actual legislative speech and debate clause that you would want to exclude if this were not Lindsey Graham just lying, right?
Right. So, yeah. He could say, hey, you can't ask me about my decisional process about, you know, the process I went through to make the decision to certify Joe Biden's victory. You can't ask me about why, you know, my decisions about not objecting to, you know, certified electors. You can't ask me about the discussions I've had following this about laws that we were trying to pass in you know on voting in the legislature.
Yeah,
but he doesn't. He just says nothing. You can't ask me anything.
And let's go more broadly. You are correct on all of those, but let me add another category. You can't ask him about horse trading or negotiations, right? So if he calls up a senator and says, hey, you know, if you'll back off on this Electoral Count Act thing, I'll support you on X, right?
Like, right.
That's that is absolutely very clear. As despicable as Lindsey Graham is,
it's protected.
I would tell you that is covered by the speech and debate clause, right? So, yeah, a good faith actor could articulate reasons to hand down guidance to what this grand jury can ask, what, you know, what can be asked of Lindsey Graham in front of the grand jury. He hasn't done that. And
so how long can this go on? Because what I imagine happening here is the court says no and just submit it again. And so he submits something else ridiculous and they say no. And they just go back and forth forever.
So
and then whatever the court decides, you know, even if they do get in a hearing and they make some sort of things that you can't say or things you don't have to talk about under speech or debate and they reach an agreement of some kind, then he's just going to appeal that up to the 11th Circuit again. So it's like, how do you see this playing out?
I think this is a version of the same argument we saw the first time around that eventually proved you correct in terms of not being a sufficient delay. Remember, the 11th Circuit said, yeah, we're going to send this back down and, you know, you figure it out. And lots of people, including people with whom we are friends and respect, said, Well, you know, this could really then drag out for weeks or months. And the trial court was like, nope, we want a brief tomorrow from Lindsey Graham. We want the opposition due Monday, which is when we got this from Fani Willis. And we want the reply brief 2 days after that on Wednesday. So as you're hearing this, Lindsey Graham will have filed his reply brief. And my guess is that the district court will rule on this Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning at the latest. And then it will be up to Lindsey Graham to try and get injunctive relief from the 11th Circuit, just like he did last time, to stop the effect of that judgment, right? Because that's what will happen. The court could even put, you know, hey, this judgment will go into effect in 72 hours, right? You know, kind of strictly cabin and do their best, you know, to force the 11th Circuit not to just sit around deliberate for a while. And then the 11th Circuit, like, it's really tough to know where they could go from here, right? Like, the panel has already said total quashal is not warranted, but go back and see if there's an argument for partial quashal. And then if the district court says, hey, there's no argument for partial quashal, then
we order him to testify. And then any issues that come up in the deposition can be litigated at that point.
Yeah, case by case basis, absolutely. Yeah.
And then it goes back, and then the court says you have 70 to 72 hours. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that would mean that the 11th Circuit would have a limited amount of time to come back and accept or deny or whatever.
Yeah, and remember, if they don't issue the stay, right, then, you know, then the appeal on the merits, you know, who cares about that, right? Like the judgment will go into effect and Lindsey Graham will be compelled to appeal. And then you can appeal that up to the Supreme Court.
Or compelled to testify, yeah.
Yeah. And then you could appeal that if the 11th Circuit declines to issue a stay. Lindsey Graham can make an emergency petition to the Supreme Court. And, you know, look, we all know where the Supreme Court is. But as, you know, you and I have both said on multiple occasions, this Supreme Court has been 100% predictable in reaching conservative policy outcomes. They have not been on the side of protecting Donald Trump shenanigans.
Nope.
So, you know, other than Clarence Thomas. And so.
Right. And then the deal with the Federalist Society might be like, just get on the court.
Yeah.
You know, and Mitch McConnell might be like, please don't let him not light himself on fire. Just leave him alone. You know, so who knows?
And it may also be even more calculating than that. Right. Like if you're Sam Alito, you may want to establish your independent cred by being like, no, Donald Trump's a buffoon. I don't owe him my job. I'm here for life, baby. And Kavanaugh may feel that way, right? Gorsuch may feel that. I don't know. I don't know what's going on in their demented little heads.
All they're there for is to overturn Roe.
Right. And they've done that. And they've got, believe me, it's not all they're there to do.
Oh, no. Well,
that was job one.
I was going to list some other things. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But no, yeah, no. Federalist Society stuff, not protect Trump stuff. Trump, the Republican Party, as soon as they find an off ramp, and Mitch McConnell already has, is just going to let him rot in the wind.
Yep.
But we'll see. There was a judge that decided that the Governor Kemp does have to testify, but won't have to do it until after the election, which led Fani Willis to say, OK, well, then we'll probably wrap up the special grand jury at the end of the year.
Yep. Yep.
That's a wrong decision in 100 ways. I'm sure that you feel the same, because what does the election have to? He's not a target.
Right. It is, again, if you want to be charitable, the best way to view it is we're bending over backwards such that there is not even an argument that these folks can make. My response back to that would be, but that's not going to stop them from making it anyway. So, you know, why
but
actually?
Now it's not a legal argument. Now it's just a political meh.
Yeah.
And Beryl Howell, who just took over, by the way, the Scott Perry phone case, the confiscation search warrant of Scott Perry, Representative Republican Scott Perry's phone, which is interesting. She has decided that a case that's been going back and forth behind the scenes with the Department of Justice about how much to release in a search warrant and affidavit and materials on Burr, the senator, Republican Senator Burr. And back in 2020, I must have tweeted, I looked it up. I looked up my advanced Twitter search, Burr. I tweeted like at least 20 times that I thought that the investigation into Burr, into insider trading, was retaliation for him about to declare that Russia and the Trump campaign conspired together. Not criminally, just politically looking at it, which is what the whole five volume thing about, you know, their counterintelligence report from the Senate Intelligence Committee came out. And then he was put under investigation. And because he was under investigation by Bill Barr, he was removed as the chair of that committee, in which in steps, then the report is released and
little
in
Marco.
Steps, little Marco to write his assessment of it. And so we don't get Burr's assessment. We got Marco's, which was totally exonerated. And so I was like, this has to be retaliatory. This has been under wraps for a while. There were never charges brought. The case was closed on January 19th, 2021.
Yep.
We don't need this anymore, says the old DOJ. And ever since then, the LA Times has been trying to get this information. And so the judge has determined, okay, there is stuff that still needs to be redacted and sealed. We'll keep that redacted and sealed. But we don't have to worry about embarrassing a public figure anymore, because he's already admitted that he was under investigation. And we don't have to worry about letting it out of the bag that the SEC was investigating him and his brother, because they've publicly said it. And then the DOJ publicly acknowledged there was a search warrant executed. And so because this is all out in the public, I'm going to let as much redacted be unredacted as possible. And so she is, the DOJ put forth some redactions that they wanted. She goes, nope, I think we can redact a little bit less. And she put that order out, and they have until, I believe, September 5th to release it to the LA Times in its new glory.
I cannot add to that summary. That is perfect in every way. Exactly correct. I will say this. When I came up with the hypothetical Republican at the apex of Yodel Mountain back in 2017 as to what it would take to change public opinion on impeaching Donald Trump, I picked Richard Burr, and I picked mm-hmm. him on the basis of his activities, his signing on to the reports of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence.
And we know, too, that Trump obstructed justice when he tried to persuade Burr to drop the whole investigation.
And then when he
didn't, then he's under investigation all of a sudden for insider trading. Now, I'm not pro-insider trading. I don't want anybody to think that at all. What I am against is weaponization of the Department of Justice to go after your political enemies who are about to release a report on you that says you colluded with Russia.
And not even political enemies, right? Like political semi-allies, the kind of...
His enemy when he was going to release this report.
Or alternatively, right? And the reason I'm pushing back on that a little bit is, if you believe that Donald Trump conducted his business in the White House like a mob boss, as we seem to have every reason to want to believe, this serves precisely the purpose, right, that a mafia don would want to serve, right? They're like, look, I'm just saying what happened to Senator Burr could happen to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is somebody who took zero verifiable public steps to bring down Donald Trump. Did he lay the groundwork? Sure. Right. Was he apparently honest in, some of the Senate subcommittee filings? Sure. But like, it's not like Burr voted for the first impeachment. Right. He's now, by the way, ex-Senator Burr. Hopefully that is Sherry Beasley's seat to win in the midterms. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the only reason I push back a little bit is because this is overwhelming force in response to somebody who had not yet taken, substantive stuff. This is not retaliation against Liz Cheney, whom they destroyed and ran out of office. Right.
Yeah.
This is preemptively bringing something and, who knows?
Sending a message, like you said, to
exactly.
Republican or Democrat. I'll come after you.
Yep.
If you fuck with me.
Yeah. So.
So I'm interested to see that, but it's going to come out before September 5th. So this filing that we're going to get tomorrow/yesterday, I can't wait to go over that with you, the DOJ filing in the Mar-a-Lago case. And I'm interested also to see what the district court does in Lindsay. We're going to cover it all on the next Cleanup on Aisle 45. I've been Allison Gill.
Whew, and I have been Andrew Torres.
and we'll see you next week. Thank you, everybody, and thanks to our new patrons. Again, you want to be a patron? Patreon.com/aisle45pod. We would love to have you. Any final thoughts there, Andrew?
No, just looking forward already to next week's show with you.
It's going to be loaded.
It's going to be fun.
All right, talk then. Until then, everybody, see you later. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo design are by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So the official podcast of The Persistence is back with season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens, with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.